I'd like to welcome you to Harvest Community Church. If we have never met, my name is Hans, and I get to serve here on staff and as one of the pastors. I'm very glad to be with you this morning as we march along in the series on Hebrews, Jesus over everything. My family and I recently did a trip to New Mexico. We hadn't stayed in New Mexico together, and we wanted to be somewhere where we could be like a day, we could get there in a day of travel. I don't like to drive long distances. Some of you are like power drivers, and you'll go 20 hours in a day. No desire to do that. I am very slow. We stop anytime somebody has to go to the bathroom. Like, it's just, I'm in no rush once I am with my family on the road to get to my destination. So we have to either go for a long time, and a long time for us is like a week, and it has like maybe a day or two of travel on the front end and a day or two of travel on the back end, depending on the speed with which we want to get there. But this particular trip, the way up was a two-day trip. Like we made it get about 8 hours and then make the last little run. And then the way home, we just did in one day because I think I had to be back for something, which is usually what ends up happening. But I particularly on the way up had a stop that I wanted to make in Roswell, New Mexico. I'd never been to Roswell. I was very disappointed by that fact. And so even as I looked at the map, because we stayed in Odessa for a night, and you're like, why? Because we like the smell of rotten eggs. Like, that's why. So we stayed in Odessa. And then we were with a church from some other evangelical free church brothers. I was hanging out with them at their church that morning. It was great. And Zach, who was on staff at that church, goes, hey, I just need you to know, basically most of your drive as you get to your destination, you're going to see nothing. You're just going to see nothing. I mean, the speed limits are like 55, and these roads, or maybe 65, they should have been 105. There's no one on the road. No one. But I'm terrified about speed traps, so everyone's just like, zoom, there's passing me. Because I'm like, I don't know when the cop's going to show up. I'm not ready for this. And so we get there, but the map, right, it actually routes me past Roswell. I was like, there is no way we're going to loop around Roswell for this thing. So I forced myself to get through Roswell because I really want to see the aliens. And like I heard, maybe Ryan Trahan went to the McDonald's UFO there, and I was like, what are we going to go see? What are we going to do? Do we want to go to the UFO museum? Like, do you think they have the real aliens there somewhere? And so you just began to go down Main Street in Roswell, and I was a little disappointed that they didn't lean in as much as I thought they should have on this whole alien thing. But at the same time, I was like, well, here we are. So I was thinking, we went to lunch. It was a late lunch. It was like 2 or 3 in the afternoon. And I was like, do we want to go to the alien museum? Do we want to go, like, find some alien DNA? Do we want to go, like, what do we want to go do? And we had previously been warned by our friend Elisa, who said, it's a pretty cool museum, but you're going to have to stop and read a lot of things, like, at all of the exhibits. I was like, well, we don't go to museums to read. We're going to skip that one because like I wanted a game or something like that, just something cool that they would have you be like, hey, turn yourself into an alien for $5 or something like that. And so we went, we had barbecue at this great little spot. We sat on a patio, we told stories, we saw no aliens. And then, I know, somebody was very sad about that. And then we made our way the next hour or two, whatever it was, to get to our final destination. So I'm not usually the biggest sucker for tourist traps. I kind of go, no, I don't need to pet the baby alligator. No, I don't need to see. There was a gas station in Louisiana that for the longest time had a live tiger at it until someone got a hold of them and said, probably shouldn't have a tiger at a gas station. But Louisiana, we're different. And so we just do that. It would have been... It's fun to stop for the diversion. It would have been ridiculous, and it would have been ridiculous if I went, you know what we need to do? We just need to move here. Like, let's move here. Let's just set down roots. I'm sure Roswell has some great churches. We can participate in those churches. We can go to the McDonald's UFO every single day. We can live our lives as residents of Roswell, New Mexico, and probably just live them out really well. Had I said that, had you gotten some message that like the second week of March, like everybody just wants you to know Hans isn't coming back. Like he stopped in Roswell and like, in fact, can one of you realtors sell his house furnished with the holes in the wall that his kids have put in there? I'm just waiting for that. So could you just go do that? You would know it was ridiculous. There's no reason that we would stop or you'd be have some announcement about me never coming back because I got caught up in a tourist trap. We recognize that that one's a little silly. You're not going to move to some place simply because you want to see an alien. A diversion may not be the same thing as a distraction, but at the same time, there are many other times in our lives, yours and mine, where our decisions get us caught for a very long time. We might not admit that we've moved in, but we have started to settle into certain kinds of things. They might even be opportunities that feel incredibly noble. All right, you have a little more time to put in at work, and so you go, well, I'm just going to put in more work doing these kinds of things, and you start to steal a little more time from your family day after day because you go, well, I'll stay a little later. You climb the ladder a little higher, one more rung up, one more opportunity, one more promotion, one more raise. And so you do that because it feels right, because you got to provide for your family, right? Like you need to do that. It's important to be responsible, to have enough money, which I don't know a person in this room who honestly goes, I have the perfect amount of money. Like everyone goes, nope, I think just like if 10% more, if I could get a 10% raise, then I'd be settled for about a week. And then you settle into the new normal and you go, I think a little 10% more would actually be okay, because once you know you're getting a 10% raise, you start spending 12% of the money you don't have. And so you just keep reaching a little higher and a little higher, and then all of a sudden you're caught up in what people would call the rat race. You don't feel like you can stop. And what felt like a good thing now has actually become a significant distraction to how you are operating in life. Experiences are one where we just live for certain kinds of experiences, maybe certain vacations, maybe certain stops at tourist traps. We just start to live our lives for certain experiences in life. And we pursue those nonstop because it feels like the right thing to pursue at the right time and in the right way. And so we start to live our life for that. We go, well, you know, it's just time for our, you know, we've spent our whole life taking care of our kids. And now that we're retired, we're going to take care of ourselves. And so you begin to build your life around the things that you think are the most important. And then your most fruitful years of impact go away. Your 60s and 70s, should the Lord continue to give you good health, are some of the most impactful years that you can have for others. The rest of us are just trying to get there in one piece. This can happen with health scares, where it's important to stay healthy, but there's a health issue or a health crisis or some chronic illness in your house, in your life, and then all of a sudden, you begin to take care of that, and before you know it, you're kind of caught up in just pursuing that end. And you might hear it where you come to worship on a Sunday morning or you show up to your life group. You'll know when it's going on in your life because you get nervous about showing up with the people that you've known for a while. Because you're afraid of how they're going to respond. Hey, where you been? What's going on? Is everything okay? How was that thing? What's this? And so when your mind starts to go, oh man, how am I going to be received when I show back up in the room and I have been gone, and you start to make your excuses. Well, it's just been a lot. It's been a busy season. Everyone's favorite phrase. I think if we could do like a word cloud of everybody's favorite phrase, they would just say busy season. It's always a busy season. Oh yeah, kids are busy right now. And then, right, grandkids, they're taking all of my time. My job's taking all of my time. I'm traveling more for work. We got the acreage we got to take care of. Just got a new property. Trying to figure this thing out. Homeschooling my kids. I saw that when I saw the McGoys. Yeah. And so we have all these things where we start to bring the reason why we aren't in some kind of place that we think that we should be, or why you haven't seen us around as much, or anything like that. And we share the ones that are safe because no one's going to feel like they fault us for working a little harder, being a little more absent because you got to take care of a few things. But honestly, I think if we reflected inwardly, we would go, I'm doing that too much. I'm letting myself get a little too caught up in things that are unnecessary. And rather than just pursue something, we actually do end up just kind of planting roots in some lifestyle or some version of what we think is the most important and build a life around that. And then we wonder what kind of impact we've left behind, what kind of growth or what kind of opportunities we left behind, because we've let things that come into all of our lives, you all have them, distract us and potentially derail us. And when we're distracted and potentially derailed, the cost and the energy that it takes to try to get back and focused can be significant. So much so that very often we can just kind of concede and go, I'm not going to pursue that anymore. Same thing goes with our walk in Christ. As we grow with Him, as we grow together, as we're in community, as we care for one another, and we have our walks with the Lord. They're not just private walks with God. We're going, well, I got my walk, you got your walk. Like, no, you get my walk too. You got to deal with the stuff that I'm dealing with. You got to pray for me. You got to talk about what's going on. I was texting with a buddy today. I said, what does it feel like to be like one of the most successful families on the face of the earth? All of his kids seem to just be like crushing it at everything. And he said, I wouldn't know. Because he always feels underwater. Always feels underwater. And in our faith walk, this journey that we're on to grow in Christ's likeness, to live faithfully, it becomes so easy to give less attention to the most important things. Now, I've tried to figure out why that is. I don't have any one answer. I mean, you could say, well, the flesh. The flesh always wants comfort or wants safety. If I were to say any reason, like, why does that happen? I think we convince ourselves that we've wasted too much time or lost too much time. Have you heard Jesse last week, where he talked about unbelief, and it's often a path you can't unwalk. And so we just look at where we got. We look at where we wish we were, and we just get discouraged and say, duh. I did think that was going to be my life. I did want to pursue God that way. I did want to pursue education like that. I did want to invest. I did want to be a leader. I wanted that. I wonder what happened. I wonder how I got derailed. Well, we just came out of a warning passage last week. It was like, you best watch out because problems are coming if you're in your unbelief, you walk away from the Lord. And this is like bad cop, good cop, because Jesse got to bring that. And then right after that passage, when you're thinking about the entire passage, we get this moment where the author gets to say, but that's not how we think it's going to be with you. And so you get this moment where you might be filled with frustration or worry or doubt or anxiety as you read the first few verses, and then you continue on and you go, oh, I don't need to feel that way. And that's what we get with the Lord. And so as we march along in Hebrews, we're going to try and answer this question today, which is, what must we remember to help us stay focused to the end? What must we remember to stay focused to the end? Certain kinds of commitments, certain kinds of reminders. And we're going to use a specific kind of theme. We're in Hebrews 6, 9 through 12, so I only get a few verses, but which is a good thing. And we're going to talk about it in that same way that we've talked about the entire book, Jesus over everything. We're going to talk about one idea over another idea, that this one's more important than that one, that this is more important than that. So we're going to hear three things here in regard to that. One is that in our identity, one is in our commitment, and one is in our motivation. Now I'm going to just go ahead and tease these for you so you can hear what's going to come with each of those. In our identity, we're going to talk about being secure over anxious. Secure over anxious. In our commitment, we're going to talk about being eager over sluggish. Eager over sluggish. And in our motivation, we will talk about future promises over present reality. Identity, commitment, motivation. The middle one, the commitment, is like the activity we do. Identity is what we remember, and motivation is what keeps us going. So we're going to, in the middle of that, talk about that commitment of eager over sluggish, but it is bookended by something that's true about us, and then something that's always true that should motivate us. And so we're kind of bookended by these ideas of what keeps us going is outside of us, and then because of that, what happens in the middle, like a nice little motivation sandwich. So let's talk about that first part. Secure over anxious. Secure over anxious. I'll read the whole passage because we're going to 9 and 10 are going to help us a lot. We just came out of all of these comments about falling away and how dangerous it is. And then you get to verse 9. Though we speak in this way, yet in your case, what's the word he uses? Beloved. Yet in your case, beloved, we feel sure of better things. Things pertaining to salvation. For God is not unjust so as to overlook your work and the love that you have shown for his name in serving the saints as you still do. And we desire each of you to show the same earnestness, to have the full assurance of hope until the end, so that you may not be sluggish, but imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. We'll begin, and the bulk of our passage, we'll just deal with that first idea of our identity being secure over anxious. Got it? Secure over anxious. So let's start with that one. Verse 9, after hearing everything that we had just heard last week, right in the passage above, about all of the dangers of falling away and all of the issues that might show up, what do we then begin to hear? But verse 9, though we speak in this way, and what is this way? All the ways pertaining to the danger of falling away. Though we speak in this way, yet in your case, beloved, we feel sure of better things. Things that belong to salvation. Now, this way being maturity, the need for it, the judgment that might come, fear, anxiety, it can produce in us all kinds of worry about our walk. Now, I have at times for years, maybe you read a passage and maybe it's Hebrews 6, maybe it's Jesus talking about the unforgivable sin, and you move into restrained panic. Is that me? Is that me? Is that me? Did I do that? Have I actually committed the unpardonable sin? Am I the one that has fallen away? Sometimes I know I don't love God as fully as I ought. And so you hear this passage right before what we just read, and it can fill us with some kind of anxiety about where our standing is before the Lord. I have sat with people, a dear brother named Mike, years and years ago, he's sitting in my office, terrified that God doesn't love him. Like his mind just would not quit over certain thoughts, and they would just buzz and buzz and buzz. And I had no idea, because Mike was perhaps the most loving guy I know. He texted me this week. I get these random texts from Mike that just goes, love you, brother. Like, just out of nowhere. Like, it's just over the course of a year, he's thinking about me. He goes, thought of you today, made me smile. Puts his initials. Got your letter, loved it. Love you. He calls me big brother. This guy's probably 60, and he's got at least 100 pounds on me. And so, big brother. Love you, brother. Love you, big bro. And yet he's in my office, just like a sack of potatoes, unsure that God loves him. Unsure that his mind is right. And it would just spin and spin and spin. And that's where so many of us can live. So what does secured over anxious look like? Well, first, just look at the tone that the author speaks about. Though we speak in this way, yet in your case, beloved, we feel sure of better things. We feel sure of better things. So there's a pastoral tone that he wants you to hear. Though it is true that unbelief is a path that's incredibly difficult to unwalk, most people are unable to unwind it when their hard-heartedness just moves them in a certain direction. And they lose fruitfulness, and they lose the joy of walking with God, and that's all gone. Though we speak in this way, and it might cause you anxiety, we believe better things for you. There's even a lesson here for us that we're about to see as he gives the reason. Because it isn't a platitude, right? It's like when our kids don't do well in their sporting event, and we go, oh, no, I believe, like, you could be a... He'd be like LeBron James, which we're a little Rockets fans are triggered by right now. He'd be like that. And I'm like, listen, I know we want to tell our kids they can be anything, but that dude's a unicorn, and if there were a whole stable of unicorns, he would be the unicorn of the unicorns. So I don't need to tell my kids you're going to be like LeBron James. Like, you're not. You're not. That guy's, he's some kind of alien. Maybe he's from Roswell. Maybe that's it. And so what the author doesn't provide is some platitude just to go, oh, no, I'm sure you'll be fine. Which is what we sometimes tell. Oh, I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm sure it'll be fine. On what evidence are you sure it'll be fine? Right? If I want to feel secure over anxious, I need something more than I'm sure you'll be fine. Go ahead. It'll be fine. What? Like, prove it's going to be fine. Show me it's going to be fine. And this is what the author does. And he doesn't even talk about, like, oh, it's going to be fine because we know God's great, which is in there. But he begins to actually talk about both God's character, what God has seen, and what the congregation has done. Look at verse 10. For God is not unjust so as to overlook, and look at what we see, your work and the love that you've shown for his name in serving the saints as you still do. Work, love that is shown in serving the saints. And so he roots it in God's character, but then demonstrates, look at what God sees about you. Look at what you have done, and you still do it. And so he doesn't root it in some platitude of going, well, we just know you'll be fine. We believe better things for you because God is not unjust, and he has seen what your transformed life has been like. He has seen it. There is evidence of it. Later on, and we're going to get, it's like 4 or 5 chapters down the road, he reminds them of how they used to joyfully receive the plundering of their property. Like, people would take from them, and they would just count themselves glad to be seen as worthy to have their things stolen from them. And so he's using their history of faithfulness. But above it and beside it and below it, he goes, but God's not unjust. He sees you. He's seen what you've done. He has seen how you have served. That God sees. And so from the anxiety, he goes, don't worry about all of these things that you think might happen. Let's talk about what has happened. Your work, your love, your service, and our unjust God doesn't overlook that. Because the assumption for the author, and the assumption would be that they are done by faith. I'm living by faith that's demonstrating itself in how I serve. And so at times you kind of have to go, no, don't forget. Don't forget what fruit has already been borne out in your life. Do you think God is not aware of that? Do you think God is going to reject that? Do you think God is going to leave that? Now for all of us here, I think this helps give us a way to speak with people. Because so often we get into a moment and go, why did you screw up right then and there? That's like the dad voice, right? Some of my kids have heard that this week. Why did you do this one particular thing? As if our life is built off of an indiscretion, a mistake, an attitude, or an action that is wholly, wholly unholy. And we think that that's going to mark us forever. That's the dad voice coming in. But what the author does here is go, no, think about God's character, what he's seen in you. And the author even goes, and I know you still care. Now, think about this. What is more motivating toward righteous living? Me telling you all the things that you're doing wrong and how much more you need to do, or me reminding you of the times that you have lived faithfully for the Lord and going, hey, I know there's more in you. I know there's more in you. So one tears down and measures you up against what you think you need to hit. And one builds up based upon what you have already done, what you've already seen. And it's surrounded by the gracious and good character of God. So what does this produce? When you begin to talk about God's justice, what God's seen, and the prior and current actions of the congregation. And the author's going, oh, we see this in you. We're not worried about your unbelief. We don't want you to go into unbelief, but let's talk about why that's not our ultimate concern here for you. He goes back to God. What does this produce in a person? This is a more popular word these days, but what it produces is a non-anxious pursuit of God, where you have nothing to prove but only joy to gain and freedom to run. You probably heard these types of statements before, so I'll repeat it. I'm not sure the first one who said it, some great man or woman prior to me, when they talk about some of the differences between just overall worldly religious systems and the gospel of grace. And overall worldly religious system says, I screwed up. I hope my dad doesn't find out. And gospel of grace says, I screwed up. I got to find my dad. The difference between those two attitudes is what the author is trying to bring about, which is God sees you. God isn't unjust. He knows where you are. He knows where you are. You don't need to run from him. You don't need to rebel from him. You don't need to hide from him. He's established you and made you who you are. And that is such the difference between a life that is joyful and delighting in Christ and a life where you are trying to earn with everything you have the favor of others or the favor of God. That one little slip up, one mess up, one screw up then puts you in some kind of island way over here and you're just exiled forever. We spend most time in that idea of our identity because we have to remember what God has done in us and what God has worked out through us. And that allows us to stand secure and gives us the motivation for that next aspect of our commitment, being eager over sluggish. It comes from a place of confidence and certainly comes with that motivation to operate. So let's look at verses 11 and the first part of verse 12. And we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness, that's what I'm saying from eagerness, earnestness to have the full assurance of hope until the end so that you may not be sluggish. So that you may not be sluggish. We'll get to the third part here in just a moment. But our desire is that each one of you show the same earnestness to have the full assurance of hope until the end. And so keep at it. Keep at your pursuit of God. Essentially, this. Anybody graduating from high school soon? Anybody down here? Yeah, one, oh, yeah. Augie, you are. Corbin, you are. All right, yeah, soon. Soon is relative. In a third more of my life. Yeah, so what are you hearing the author say? Don't get senioritis about your faith. Don't get senioritis about your faith, where you go, well, everything to learn has been learned, and everything to do has been done, and everything to think has been thought, and every way to serve has been served, and thus, we're in coast mode. Our desire is that you show the same earnestness. The pastoral aim here is an energetic pursuit of God. Sometimes eager people can be quite annoying. And the reason they're quite annoying is because they challenge us. They remind us of perhaps what we had once been, how we had once pursued. And so we have to justify, well, no, but yeah, you'll learn, or you'll grow up, or you'll see. But I bet, and it doesn't matter your age, I bet you have some weird thing, some hobby, something that you love, and that if maybe I were to ask somebody close to you, because you may not admit it, so I could ask your spouse, your kids, your friends, your family, somebody. I want to ask somebody, what pursuits exist in your life that you get eager about? You just are ready. Like it doesn't matter what time it is. It doesn't matter what day it is. You will not get up in the morning to pray, but you will get up in the morning to jog 70 miles. Okay, go get that. Somebody's like, I'm not touching 70 miles ever. Yeah. We have all kinds of things that we will orient our lives around, that we will pursue with a certain level of zeal. that often gets missed in other ways. So eager over sluggish, I think we see what that means, because sluggishness, that potential outcome, is when you just throttle back and you give less attention to it. I was, you know, anybody who's coached a team in any way, and I mean like an athletic team, but it happens, we can make some kind of metaphorical connection to it as well. Injury shows up when you let off the gas. The easier that you take it, oh, this isn't that big of a deal, it's not that hard, right? You might know the phrases, you play like you practice. When you start to go, oh, this isn't that big of a deal, we don't need to try that hard, that's when you begin to see injury. Because you start to play it safe. And you don't engage all of you in whatever it is that you're doing. Now, when it comes to our faith, it's a day in, day out, regular pursuit. It doesn't stop. We should take no days off. We should exhaust ourselves in all of the right ways for these things. And yet we might find it so much easier to be eager or earnest about other pursuits than our own holiness and walk with the Lord. You will find peppered throughout Hebrews these little pastoral exhortations. And they sound things like this: don't stop meeting together, as is the habit of some. Can you hear that? What is sluggishness but the habit of pursuing less important things? The habit of pursuing less important things. And when that begins, that's where drift starts. You don't have to answer this out loud. Please don't. That'd be weird. But I'm going to give you two blanks. Just if you're journaling, if you're writing, answer this question. An area where I know I have lacked zeal is what? An area where I just know I've lacked zeal. I haven't been as concerned about it. I haven't been like in the, for some it's I don't read God's word regularly. I don't pray with any consistency. I don't serve others joyfully. I protect my own life and my own resources. I don't give generously. I have let go here. I've stopped caring about this. I have resigned this area of my life to just not be an area that God can transform. Or I've stopped caring. Whatever that is in that blank, I would just wonder what you would put in the following blank. Because once you realize it, right, you're kind of on record. And I commit to what? I commit to what? What's in the second blank? So often we go super general with these. I commit to love God more. I would encourage you to try this exercise. Just ask yourself the question, how? How will that show up? Until you can get to a specific action that you can actually do. How will I love God more? Well, I'm going to be around other Christians more often and serve them and joyfully serve them. How will you do that? Well, I'm just going to look for opportunities. How are you going to look for opportunities? Oh, I'm going to, like, right, like, just keep asking how until you can get to something that you can actually stand on. And then do that thing. When we live in generalities, we can find ourselves getting, it becomes very easy just to stay there forever. Now, here's the thing. I was talking with a guy just recently about this. I said, man, I promise you, in coming to faith, like, you're going to think you got to make all of these life changes before you get there. You're just gonna think like, I gotta fix this, I gotta fix this, I gotta fix this. I said, we always feel those things. I said, all I'm concerned about for you is, what do you believe about Jesus? Then you get the rest of your life for you and him to work this out. You don't have to get all this right and then go, okay, Lord, I think this is how it's gonna look. You just make that first yes. And then you just keep going. There's stuff that God is working on in my heart now regarding my pride, my inattention to people's needs, my lack of love at the opportune moment. And I just walk around right now with just a pretty steady state of conviction about that. Not in a bad way. I don't wallow in it, but just a steady state of conviction about my lack of presence with people. I'm like, that's just where God has me right now. And it's been, I don't know, weeks, months, the whole year. That's okay. A year ago, I would have never said that was a problem. It is now. Was it a problem a year ago? Yeah. But now's the time that God draws it out. So when I say, what do you see where you're lacking zeal, and what are you going to do? What do you commit to? It's just God going, all right, now it's time. Let's look at that. Secure over anxious, eager over sluggish, and then finally our motivation. We'll spend more time next week on the motivation, so this is just the teaser preview of coming events. Our motivation being future promises over present reality. You read in verse 12, so that you may not be sluggish. Then there's the contrasting idea given on the second half. But imitators, mimickers of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. So we don't want you to be sluggish. We want you to be, pick one, like Abraham, who had a promise, sometimes waffled in his confidence that God would live out that promise, but did finally and assuredly recognize that God would do the thing he said he was going to do and set the course of his life on it. And even though there might have been times where it seemed like it was deviating, he got to the place where God had told him he was going to be. So we don't want you to be sluggish, because that's when you stop paying attention, but rather be imitators of those who through faith, belief in what God has said, and patience, a confidence that it's going to come to be, inherit what God said would happen. Now, he's using this for the congregation in this way because he knows their temptation is to abandon Jesus because it's becoming a little more hostile. There's more persecution and there's more pressure. And so what he's saying is, yes, as you live through this life, you are going to find those moments where you're going to be tempted to back up. Don't do it. Be imitators of those who through faith, confidence in what God has said, and patience, knowing that it will come to be, even if it doesn't come to be right now, even if it doesn't show up in this present moment, even if you don't feel like you're really close to God right now, even if you don't feel like there's a lot of motivation, even if you don't feel like your life is coming together, we love to talk about how we feel, imitators of those who through faith and patience obtain the promises. Now, we're going to get into a long explanation of that as we finish out chapter 6 next week. So how do we stay focused? How do we stay focused to the end? How do we stay out of the tourist trap, the distraction? We need to remember that our identity for those in Christ is secured. God is not unjust, and he sees you. We need to remember that we have a commitment of an eager pursuit of God over a sluggish, lazy pursuit of God. But that is built in a motivation that God has said that things are going to come about and he is going to make good on every promise that he has made. And so we are motivated. That pulls us. That's what helps motivate the eagerness, is a recognition of that promise. Now, a couple things that come there. We know the resurrection is real. If the resurrection is real, how does that change your cancer diagnosis? How does it change the rolled ankle or the stubbed toe? How does it change the fact that you know you're going to die? Through faith and patience, we live this life faithfully because we know better life is coming. And we do not live as if this life is all there is. Because if we live as this life is all there is, we are going to be filled with distractions. because we're going to be concerned that what God has promised isn't going to come to be. We'll see more about God's promise and just how much effort he puts in toward us to demonstrate his faithfulness as we continue on this next week. Pray with me.